Impossible to imagine the work that Isaac Newton did without the ingenious instrument makers who swarmed in London from the middle of the 1600s onwards.
The Seven Ages of Science over on BBC Radio 4 begins on Tuesday evening at 9.
And this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. The time is just after 1 o'clock. I'm Jill Anderson, and here's a summary of the news. The Foreign Office has confirmed that the British Embassy in Yemen is to close for 2 days from tomorrow because of heightened concerns about security. The move follows a decision by the United States to issue a global travel alert and to shut 21 of its embassies and consulates because of a possible attack by Al-Qaeda. Officials in Afghanistan say at least 8 people have been killed and more than 20 wounded in an attack outside the Indian consulate in Jalalabad. Police say suicide bombers detonated a car packed with explosives at a checkpoint in the city. An Indian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the victims included Afghan security personnel and civilians. The managing director of Twitter in the United Kingdom has apologised to the women who've experienced abuse on the website. Tony Wang said the abuse, which included threats of murder and rape, was not acceptable. The company says it's adding a report abuse button to each tweet displayed on its website. Environmental campaigners in the village of Balcombe in West Sussex are protesting for the 10th day at the site where the energy company Quadrilla has begun exploratory drilling for oil. Protesters fear the work will lead to the use of the controversial fracking process, although the company has insisted that it has no immediate plans to do this. Egypt's Interior Ministry has called for supporters of the former president, Mohamed Morsi, to end their sit-ins and return to their homes. In a television statement, it said such a move would allow the Muslim Brotherhood to return to the political process. The authorities in New Zealand have ordered a global recall of up to 1,000 tonnes of dairy products because of a botulism scare. Fonterra, the world's largest dairy exporter, says that tests have revealed a type of bacteria that could cause paralysis or attack the intestinal systems of young children. And the weather. There'll be sunny spells and scattered showers this afternoon. The heaviest rain will be in the north and west. There'll be a brisk southwesterly breeze, but it will feel warm in the sunshine, with highs of 24 degrees. That's BBC News and Weather. It's 3 minutes past one. Well, now, here's today's early music show, which is introduced by Catherine Bott. Welcome to the first of a pair of programmes marking the 450th anniversary of the birth of John Dowland. That was his galliard on If My Complaints Could Passions Move, the encore to a spellbinding late-night recital given at the 2013 York Early Music Festival by the American lutenist Paul Odette. His programme, Dowland's Grand Tour, was devised to shed new light on the great Elizabethan musician's career and the players and composers who influenced him. So, when we talked in York, I began by asking Paul how good a lute player Dowland had been.
He must have been a very good player because the technical demands of his music show us what kinds of things he was capable of playing. There's a lot of virtuosity. There's a lot of complex counterpoint, which is very challenging to make all of the voices clear at all times. And yet, Dowland was a very practical lute player in that he never requires you to do something that is particularly awkward. The Italians and the Germans in the 16th century, when they started writing four-part counterpoint on the lute, people like Simone Molinaro and Melchior Neusiedler, for instance, write in four parts and they keep all four voices. And that makes demands, especially on the left hand, that you would just have to say there are a lot of awkward passages to grab that many notes on the instrument and keep all of the lines clear. Dowland would happily let go of the fourth voice if arriving on an important chord was more elegant and easier to do technically than to grab all of the voices and to maintain perfect counterpoint. So there are lots of places when you analyze Dowland's music where voices come and go. But that's what makes his music sound so human and so natural, because he doesn't require you to stand on your head and to do all of these contorted left-hand fingerings in order to maintain perfect four-point counterpoint at all times.
So he's a kind musician. He helps you.
He knew how to make the lute sound very good. It's often difficult with some of the Italian and German music to make it sound idiomatic on the instrument, because it's just so hard to keep all of those parts. So even if you try to play a Dowland piece which is too difficult, you still have the feeling that it's written in a user-friendly way. And I think that that humanity in the writing is part of the expression in the music. That comes through. The story behind this program was that when I was invited to come and play a program at the York Early Music Festival, I was on the road and I did not have an internet connection where I was for several days. So when the invitation arrived by email, I was many days late in responding, and Delma Tomlin feared that I was not going to be able to do it. So she asked Jacob Lindberg if he would like to play a Dowland program. And Jacob was sitting at his computer when the email arrived and immediately sent a program of Dowland's best solo lute works. And when I wrote back, Delma said, "Oh dear, we would love to have you come and play, but Jacob has proposed this program. Can you still play a Dowland program?" And I thought, maybe a program of not Dowland's best works is not in the best interest of the audience, although there are enough good pieces for two programs. If you take all of the best pieces away, obviously the program will not be as deep and rich as it could have been. And I thought maybe another approach would be to present the music that Dowland heard on his grand tour. Of course, we associate grand tours with the 18th century, but Dowland was maybe one of the earliest to try this kind of thing, in that he spent his apprenticeship in Paris with the ambassador to France, Sir Henry Cobham, and was in Paris for many years and would have met and heard all of the leading French lute players of the time. And dance music was, of course, extremely important in France in this time, and so I put together a group of typical dances of the type Dowland would have heard in France that almost certainly inspired some of his short, witty dance pieces. ¶¶
Thank you. a suite of 16th century French dances by Monsieur Anonymous, played by Paul Odette. One of the composers whom Dowland met on his travels was Melchior Neusiedler. I asked Paul Odette to tell me a little about him.
Melchior Neusiedler is probably the most important 16th century instrumentalist no one has ever heard of. He was extremely highly regarded at the time. He was legendary, you could say, in that he wrote very virtuosic music for the lute, which was published in Germany and in Italy and circulated in manuscript throughout Europe, including Elizabethan manuscripts here. And I think he was a very difficult personality. He never got the kind of court position that he wanted. He worked for the Fugger family in Augsburg his whole career, but every time he tried to get a job at an important court, he rubbed someone the wrong way and was thrown out. I think he lasted a few months at the court of the Archduke in Innsbruck when he was caught eating meat during Lent and was fired. But Melchior was extremely prolific. We have more than 240 solo pieces by him, a very high level, both of quality of the counterpoint. He's one of the writers who wrote in four-part counterpoint for the lute as if he were writing for a consort of viols, and sometimes in quite difficult keys. And in some of the manuscripts, it's interesting that we find the same fantasia transposed into a different key to make it easier to play. And so it's interesting to see how the players of the day in the late 16th century wanted to play his music but had to figure out how to make it easier to play. He must have been an amazing player to have written music of this complexity.
Well, he was born in 1531 and died in 1590, so he's quite a lot older than John Dowland. Where would Dowland have encountered him?
I don't think Dowland would ever have met Melchior Neusiedler, but he certainly knew the music. There are a few places in Dowland's fantasias where he quotes Melchior Neusiedler's fantasias, one of the ones that I've played on the program, and many other quotes from passages of Melchior Neusiedler. The latest research indicates that Neusiedler died in 1594, which was the year before Dowland made his big trip to Germany. So there must have been copies of Melchior's music circulating throughout Germany when he was there. And there are, as I mentioned before, some copies in Elizabethan manuscripts. So they circulated in England as well. Thank you.
Four pieces by Melchior Neusiedler, one of the most highly regarded lute players in 16th century Germany, played by Paul Odette. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and this weekend we're celebrating the genius of John Dowland. This programme is available to download via the Radio 3 website. When I talked to lutenist Paul Odette about Dowland's European travels, the next stop was Italy and a musician called Simone Molinaro.
Dowland relates all of the cities that he visited when he was in Italy. His ultimate goal was to go to Rome to study with the great madrigal composer Luca Marenzio, who was his favorite composer, and he wanted the chance to work with Marenzio, but that didn't work out, that particular plan. But he lists Genova as one of the cities that he visited, and Molinaro was a young virtuoso lute player in Genova at the time, later was the maestro di cappella at the cathedral in Genova. And there are many echoes in Dowland's music of pieces in Molinaro's book of 1599. So there's no question that Dowland was inspired by Molinaro's lute music. And interestingly, in a copy of a printed book by Jean-Baptiste Bessard of lute music from 1603, which is in the Genoa Library, there is an appendix, a handwritten appendix, which includes a piece by Dowland. And my theory is that Molinaro got this from Dowland when he visited Genoa and copied this out in the book. Thank you.
a fantasia, a ballo, a saltarello, and another fantasia by the Italian Simone Molinaro, dashed off in style by the American lutenist Paul Odette. What would you tell a young lute player about how to go about mastering the instrument to make playing it sound as easy as you do?
It's an excellent question. And I would answer to a young student of the lute or any instrument that the secret is in developing your technique very slowly, very gradually, and very systematically. The problem for most people today is we're all impatient and we want to have our first lesson and learn how the instrument is tuned and then play the most difficult piece in the repertoire the second week. And that immediately causes technical problems if you try to go too fast, because every time you try to do something that's too difficult for you, it causes the musculature to tense up, because the human body is very clever. And if we're worried about something, we tense up. So the idea is to try to learn how to play in as relaxed a fashion as possible, learning how to make a good sound on the instrument, playing very slowly, learning how to connect two notes, making sure that everything you do, you have complete control over. Bit by bit, you add a new technical issue to master. And my first rule of practicing is never practice a mistake, because anything you repeat becomes reinforced. So this notion that a lot of people have that, well, I'll keep practicing this difficult passage until I get it right. If you play it 1,000 times with the incorrect mechanics, the 1,001st time has a very good chance of being just as wrong as the other 1,000. But if you learn to practice very slowly and find the mechanical flaws and inefficiencies, if you can play something slowly 9 times perfectly, you have a very good chance on the 10th attempt that it will also be perfect. So the whole notion of practicing perfection teaches your musculature to stay relaxed and calm so that you're always in control of things instead of desperately trying to do something which is beyond you.
Of course, we couldn't have a programme in our Dowland weekend without any music by the man himself. Paul Odette was robust in his refutation of the idea that John Dowland went around in a permacloud of melancholy.
No, I think that's an unfortunately one-sided view of a composer I think of as the most versatile, the richest, most inventive of all Elizabethan composers. If you look at Dowland's short, witty pieces, you could make a case that he was the best composer of lighthearted music in the period, because he excelled at that sort of music as well. Mistress Winter's Jump and Lady Hunsdon's Puff and Mrs. White's Nothing and Mistress White's Thing and so on. Very cheeky, witty pieces that nobody else had that same sense of humor that Dowland had. But yet today, when people give programs of Dowland, they tend to consist of Semper Dowland, Semper Dolens, and Lacrimae, and In Darkness Let Me Dwell, and it, you know, all of the deepest, saddest songs. And those are truly amazing works. There's no question about it. But I always think they're more effective if they have the context of the more energetic or lighthearted or witty pieces surrounding them.
So finally, Paul, how did you actually make a selection of the three pieces that you're ending your recital with? Now, I can see that there's an Italian influence with the first one because it's called La Mia Barbara. And then we have Dowland's Galliard and A Fancy. Now, I know it's from Fantasia, but it's such an English idea calling it a fancy, isn't it?
Yes, yes. All three fascinating pieces. La Mia Barbara only survives in German sources. And I suspect that he may have composed it while he was in Germany. The consort version was published in Germany. The keyboard version of that also circulated in German manuscripts. So it's a fairly late work, but one of his most beautiful pavans with quite virtuosic Italianate diminutions that I believe were inspired by another great lutenist that he probably met in Italy, Giovanni Antonio Terzi. Dowland's Galliard is the early version of a piece which became known as the King of Denmark's Galliard, which actually in midlife was called the Battle Galliard. And then he renamed it the King of Denmark's Galliard. And this is the very earliest version of that. But I particularly like this version because there's a kind of youthful exuberance about it that I think is quite fetching.
Well, it's a very helpful corrective to the standard image. I mean, bring on the youthful exuberance.
Yes, exactly. And then the Fancy at the end of the program is a truly schizophrenic work, and I think that that's its strength. It begins as an Italian canzone alla francese, the style that you would hear played by string or brass ensembles. One thinks of Gabrielli, for instance, that style with the repeated note subject. And then at a certain point, it morphs into a flamboyant Italian toccata with flourishes up and down the instrument, and then cadences. And there's a very serene passage over a cantus firmus, which is related to the Old English in nomine cantus firmus, of the kind of music that you would hear played on the organ with a slow-moving melody line and counterpoint weaving around that. And that lasts about five bars. And Dowland remembers how much fun it was in Italy, and he finishes with this flamboyant toccata again at the end. But it's fascinating to follow the musical influences behind each of the sections in the piece, because I think that's the key to understanding how to approach the piece interpretively.
Paul Odette. After a selection of pieces by composers who influenced John Dowland, Paul Odette ended his York recital with music by the man himself, La Mia Barbara, Dowland's Galliard, and finally, A Fancy. More on John Dowland in tomorrow's Early Music Show.
Paul Odet with three pieces by John Dowland, La Mia Barbara, Dowland's Galliard and A Fancy, recorded at last month's York Early Music Festival. Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Salford by Les Pratt and Lyndon Jones. And you can download that programme as a podcast. Just follow the links from the Radio 3 website. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, we'll be joining the audience at Cadogan Hall in London for a concert of music by Britten, Holst, Lennox Barclay and Tippett. But now there's another chance to hear last Monday's All Britain Proms Chamber Music Concert from Cadogan Hall. The soprano Ruby Hughes and tenor James Gilchrist join with the pianist Imogen Cooper and guitarist Christoph Dennott in Songs from the Chinese and A Charm of Lullabies. But to start, Britain's first canticle, My Beloved is Mine. The text is a poem by the early 17th century poet Francis Quarles, itself inspired by a quotation from the Song of Solomon. To perform My Beloved is Mine, here are James Gilchrist and Imogen Cooper.
If all those glittering monarchs that command the servile quarters of this earthly ball should tender in exchange their shares of land, I would not change my fortunes for them all. Their wealth is but a counter to my coin. The world's but theirs. Desires unto the least remove. No time, no place, no chance, no death. No time, no place, no chance, no death can bar my least desires unto the least remove. He's firmly mine by oath, I his by vow. He's mine by faith, and I am his by love. He's mine by water, I am his. My wine, thus I, my best beloved am. Thus he is mine, thus he is mine. He is my altar.
James Gilchrist and Imogen Cooper were performing the first of Britain's five canticles, My Beloved Is Mine. There are five songs in Britain's A Charm of Lullabies, which we'll hear next. They are Blake's Cradle Song, The Highland Baloo by Robert Burns, Robert Greene's Sephestia's Lullaby, A Charm by Thomas Randolph, and The Nurse's Song by John Philip. To join Imogen Cooper is Radio 3's new generation artist, Ruby Hughes.